FM and WBAI.org on the web, usually at 3 p.m. You'd be tuning in to Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton. Hugh will be back tomorrow. That's right, tomorrow at 3 p.m. Right now, stay tuned for a special presentation by the Open Center.
My name is Araceli Brown, and I'm speaking here from the New York Open Center show. Today, I have a special presentation about an event that's happening in November. And for the next 2 hours, we'll be speaking to scholars and renowned performers who will be part of this very unique experience. Now, this is a collaborative effort between New York Open Center and the Ibn Arabi Society, and we're going to be talking about what these two organizations do and who they are and what this event is about. It's a conference called Ibn Arabi and Rumi, Teachings for the Modern World. This will be happening on November 4 and 5. And the conference will be held at Columbia University. Now, we will be having and including international scholars from the U.S., Europe, and the Middle East, who basically have devoted their careers to translating and interpreting works of these great mystics from the Middle East. The keynote speakers, if you are at all familiar with this area, is James W. Morris. We have Fatima Kashavaz, who is an expert on Rumi and a literary figure herself. Michael Sells, who is an expert on Ibn Arabi. And Narges Virani, who is here in New York at NYU. And there are several other speakers and performers. We also have a renowned musician. These are just speakers that will be at the conference. Not everybody else that I'm speaking about is going to be here. But our special guest will... This is our, by the way, this is our second biannual series of this conference based on Ibn Arabi. This is a mystic born in Spain. Back in 1165, we're going back that year. And we're going to be discussing more in depth about the qualities of why his teachings are important to the world today. Spiritually speaking, also in Sufism and mysticism and how they connect to Abrahamic religions. And also because I feel that a lot of the Middle Eastern philosophies and spiritual thoughts are a little talked about or taught really in the West. So that is one of the points of having this wonderful conference happen. Now, just to give you a picture of how this is going to go, we're going to have a Friday night, which is the 4th of November, and we're going to have the keynote speaker. We're going to have poets speaking in Arabic, reciting in Arabic and Persian, translating into English. We will have also a well-known Turkish musician by the name of Omar Tekbilek. And if you're familiar with his wonderful music, you will definitely want to come and hear him. Then also, the Saturday will be a full day of plenaries of lectures, workshops, panel discussions, poetry readings. And then in the evening, we will be, of course, surrounded by the beautiful poetry of Coleman Barks and the beautiful cellist, also David Darling. Then we will, of course, hear from a wonderful British actor by the name of Aaron Cass. So we have a breakdown of basically what the evening will go. There will be a whirling dervish, and as we go along, we'll discuss this. Nick, are you there?
I am.
Hi. I can actually not hear you on this. Let me go on here. But I want to introduce Nick. Nick is one part of the partner organization that we're working with, the Ibn Arabi Society. And let me tell you a little bit about Nick, first of all. Nick holds a master's degree in transpersonal psychology, and he works as an IT manager in software in California, where he is calling us from. He is a director of the United States branch of the Ibn Arabi Society, which promotes teachings and translations of this great spiritual teacher. And he is a great ongoing student of the Bishara School of Intensive Esoteric Education in Scotland. And we're going to learn a little bit more about this. And, Nick, can you tell us a bit more about the Ibn Arabi Society and how you came to love this work?
Yes. I've been involved in the Ibn Arabi Society since it was founded in 1977 when I was living in England. And mm-hmm. I was a student at the Bishara School. Mm-hmm. And a number of people that I was in association with decided that the work of Ibn Arabi was hugely underrepresented in the Western world. At that time, I don't think there were more than two or three books of his in translation. So there was a real need to get the word out on Ibn Arabi, who is the author of reputedly something like 350 works, some of which are huge. One in particular, the Futuhat al-Makkiyah, when translated in English, is expected to take over 30 volumes. So this is a monumental writer, thinker, mystic, poet, who has a profound message for the West, we believe, and is someone that we have been promoting through the Ibn Arabi Society as a way to enable translators, writers, academics to get a hold of manuscripts, conferences that are put on every year mm-hmm. in order to promote his works, mm-hmm. and also to bring his teachings to a very receptive Western audience that is looking for meaningful and fundamental ways of rethinking our relationship to the divine and what we mean by self-transformation. So these are some of the key points, I think.
Well, the key points, exactly. Basically, how we are interpreting, some would say, basically, the words of the divine into the material plane and how we can actually benefit as humans or humanity can benefit from them, especially in this in these times right now of great turmoil. I think that many people need to search for something a little bit with deeper meaning. We also have Michael Sells on the line. Michael, are you there? Hello?
Hello.
Hi. Hi, Michael. Hi. I want to introduce Michael Sells to you, being that actually we were supposed to have Fatima, but we're not able to get a hold of her. I just want to introduce Michael Sells. He is a PhD, is John Henry Barrows, Professor of Islamic History and Literature at the Divinity School of the University of Chicago. He teaches courses in the area of Quranic studies, Sufism, Arabic, and Islamic love poetry, Ibn Arabi mystical literature, and religion and violence. He's published several books, and he also has written a variety of other works. And Michael, if you could please, first of all, let's talk a little bit about the name Ibn Arabi. The conference itself is named Ibn Arabi and Rooming Teachings for the Modern World, but most people will refer to it right now as the Rumi Conference because they see the word Ibn Arabi and they're not very familiar with it or how to pronounce it. If we could just start in that respect.
Yes, well, the word, which is short for Ibn al-Arabi, mm-hmm. Actually just means if you could make it into an English name, it would be Arabson, like you would say Michelson or Jackson. Arabson, that'd be son of the Arab. It was his name, and he actually is very conscious of that particular name. And in one of his major works of love poetry, he talks about himself as Arabson, son of the Arab, and his love for a woman from Isfahan who is a Persian background, and he gives a East and West can meet kind of interpretation of that kind of love.
I'm sorry. So
there?
Yes, I'm sorry. We caught something here. Go on.
So I would just think of it in terms of the name as I'm just trying to familiarize a sense of what the name is. It's not an, you know, it's a, actually a very comfortable name when you realize what it means. And it refers to one of the, not only the author of one of the most important resources in a whole area of religion and literary worlds.
Yes.
But the culmination of centuries of thought, poetry, and mysticism
so,
within that part of the world.
So basically, a lot of people do not know him and introduce him. So we are basically right now introducing him and what his work was about in the period that he came from and how he affected Sufism, first of all, and what were some of the contributions that Ibn Arabi gave to the world that we are not familiar with today?
Well, let me just start from the fact that he probably wrote one of the most love-infused, inclusive, but highly rigorous understandings of religion in the world,
mm-hmm.
of anyone that that we have in any heritage. And he has a superb criticism of dogmatism and intolerance of all forms in religious theology. As Nick mentioned, he is said to have composed over 300 books. One of those books is coming out in a new edition, which would probably be over 30 volumes.
Right.
And, but mentioning volume doesn't really help matters. What's extraordinary is the variety and the beauty of the writing, the depth of the writing. And that's why it's, I think, Ibn Arabi Society's contributions over the past decades in making this material available and in setting up international forums, because there is a huge interest in Ibn Arabi's writings internationally, has been so important.
Internationally. How is he regarded in Europe and the Middle East compared to the United States? Because this is kind of unfamiliar territory here.
Well, I would say that Ibn Arabi has an extraordinary following of those who have contacted his ideas. It's hard to judge where it's greatest. I think what the Ibn Arabi conferences have done over the last several decades is bring scholars, artists, activists, poets together from around the world. That would be Europe, Japan, Central Asia, all parts of Africa, the United States, Australia,
mm-hmm.
And by generating that kind of community, it's one of the few real international societies for the studies of a major figure that's been this active.
Wow. Could you tell us a little bit about your talk at the conference? You will have actually a plenary talk and then a workshop.
I will be talking about two related aspects. One is Ibn Arabi's poetry in this remarkable century, the 13th century of the Christian era, the 7th century of the Islamic era, in which powerful currents of love lyricism and mystical thought were coming together with astonishing speed. This involved several of the founders of the major Arabic Sufi poetic traditions of the classical period. It involved Rumi. It involved the Turkish poetry of Yunus Emre. It involved the woman mystical poet of one of the founding figures of Dutch literature, Hedewig,
mm-hmm.
all within a few years. And I'll be talking about how their poetry, whether or not we can divine any specific influences one direction or another, how their poetry participates in a very common world of bringing together love poetry and mystical longing.
Well,
the second aspect, yeah.
Right. Oh, just to hit upon some of the things that make him kind of unique to me as well, and maybe you can hit on this a little bit. The background of Ibn Arabi himself, and for example, that he was someone that also had teachers who were women, which is something that we usually don't hear about, just because it's a certain kind of stereotyping of what the Middle East is about. And if you could talk about his learning. I mean, he seems to have gathered an enormous amount of learning in a short period of his time.
We are fortunate in Ibn al-Arabi's case that we have an extraordinary range of autobiographical writings where he talks about his life, his experiences, and his teachers. Mm-hmm. And he's written about depth and profundity about several dozen of his teachers, a number of whom were women. And these are some of the most vivid portrayals of women sheikhs, the feminine would be sheikhas, of the classical period. At the beginning of his great volume of lyrical poetry that I'll be talking about, mm-hmm. Starts out with him talking about how he was in Mecca, and he wanted to study with one of the great scholars there, who was also a woman, and her name is Fakhr Nisa, Pride of the Women. Women, and he said, no, she should be Pride of all the scholars.
Ah.
And he's very much a resource, and one of the great medieval scholars. And I don't know how many there are in any tradition
mm-hmm.
that talk with this kind of sensitivity about their women teachers.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is a fantastic piece of news for me. And even just looking at what he was able to do, my understanding is that he was actually able to, in detail, write down a history of Sufism that had traveled basically through word of mouth or transmission, which was kind of the way that it was known when it came to a lot of spiritual thought, and that he was able to connect Sufis before him and after him, and that at the same time he was also able to influence the East and Western orders of Sufism, and that included Rumi as work. And is that correct?
Some of these things are fascinating for their mystery. There's a wonderful article called Did the Two Oceans Meet by Omid Safi,
mm-hmm.
Which traces the fact that Rumi and Ibn al-Arabi were very close to one another. We know that Rumi's teacher, Shams of Tabriz,
mm-hmm.
Was a member of Ibn al-Arabi's study circles and writes about that. And if we can trust the biographies, Rumi lived in Damascus for a few years at the same time Ibn al-Arabi was living in Damascus.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the great mysteries is that do people, even at that time, Rumi probably would have been fairly well known. Ibn al-Arabi, of course, was famous. And, is it possible that they wouldn't have known of one another's work? Why don't they mention one another?
Mm-hmm.
And that brings up a whole fascinating protocol about who is mentioned in these works and who isn't. I would say to the questions of influence that the patterns of empathy between Rumi and Ibn al-Arabi are so deep and so profound and so multi-leveled
mm-hmm.
That I prefer to think in terms of transfluence. That they were both, to use a popular way of expressing it, they were both channeling powerful, deep currents that were historical. They were bringing them, in a sense, to a culmination. They were channeling currents that were contemporary currents, as you mentioned, from mm-hmm. Ibn al-Arabi's homeland in present-day Spain,
mm-hmm.
Throughout the eastern part of the Arab world in Turkey. Rumi came from present-day near Afghanistan,
mm-hmm.
and they were bringing these together. And they're, I think of it in terms of transfluence, that here are two remarkable people, and we may never know
exactly
when they met, if they did.
And how has this work affected your life personally?
I think, like many people that have encountered it in the Larrabee, it's a mark of constant joy. There are so many levels of depth, of insight, of kind of celebration of life,
mm-hmm.
An openness to learning, a mm-hmm. sense that every moment of that one can learn anything is actually a moment of inexhaustible profundity that we're not often conscious of, and he helps make us conscious of that. I would just say it. There's nothing like learning, teaching, and exploring the world of the vast and very and diverse world of Ibn al-Arabi's works.
Well, one just pointing to that, and if someone, let's say, wanted to think about, well, I want to attend this conference, I myself know my experience of just being in a reading group for Ibn Arabi was that I felt a presence work with the work itself just by reading the material, and it's what I would call a sacred presence. How does this really relate to us today, do you feel, in that sense that does it bring the presence of the sacred into our lives? Is he giving us, of course, the divine connection?
That is what's fascinating to me about that is that I think each person that comes in contact with the work of Ibn al-Arabi would probably have a different answer to that question on
uh-huh.
on how it opens up the sacred. But what I think Ibn al-Arabi's writings do is, instead of telling people about what we're calling the sacred, his writings open that world up in a variety of ways by breaking down assumptions about it, by opening up the sense of mystery, by breaking apart the kind of frozen ideas that he believed encrusted the world of talking about religion and the sacred.
Mm.
And by infusing his writings with, you could call it the sacred erotic element, the sense of deep love yearning.
Fantastic. We are really looking forward to the conference, of course. This is going to be a very unique event in New York and really in the country, because this has rarely been done like this. Because I know throughout Europe and the United States, I mean, not Europe and the Middle East, this is more of a constant than it is here, at least in the numbers that we're trying to do this coming November. So, Michael, thank you so much for being on with us.
It's been a great pleasure.
Yes, and we will be, of course, seeing you soon.
I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, thank
you. It is one of the joys of my career to be able to attend these events on Ibn al-Arabi. And I can say in parting that mm-hmm. what is so remarkable about it is it brings together the most learned specialists in history, language, philosophy, theology. It brings together artists. It brings together poets. It brings together spiritual mm-hmm. seekers.
Well,
and it's that diversity that
yes.
really makes these events shine.
Thank you so much. All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is WBAI at 99.5 FM here. We'll be right back. And now we are back with a scholar by the name of Narges Virani, who's right here from the city at NYU. And we also have on the line one of the directors from the Ibn Arabi Society, which is a partner organization for this conference. And it is really about the Ibn Arabi conferences that we started back in 2009. So, Narges, welcome.
Thank you, Arsali.
Thank you. I want to just say a little bit more about you. Narges is an assistant professor of Arabic at the New School, University Liberal Studies in New York. She has a PhD in Arabic and Islamic Studies from Harvard. And she has studied the Quranic with the Sheikh al-Sahar, sorry about massacring the name there, mosque in Cairo, and holds a shahada and ishasa, permission to teach Quran. Her doctoral dissertation entitled The Nightingale of the Merciful Macaronic. Well, we're going to be talking a little bit more about that. And she's currently writing a book. Well, it'll include a translation into English of all of Rumi's multilingual verses in Arabic, Persian, Turkish, Greek, Armenian, which is quite vast there. Rani, just if you could tell us a little bit more about how you came to love the work of Rumi. You are from India, yes?
That's correct, yeah. And before I start, I know you mentioned a couple of times I teach at NYU, actually.
I'm sorry, I made a mistake
school.
There.
That's fine. I just wanted to make that. We are close enough geographically, but two separate universities.
Yes.
I was familiar, even as a child, with works of Rumi through his stories that I heard in the family often enough, mostly of ethical import. Sometimes, you know, parents would use them to get the kids to do what they wanted to. So there were all kinds of stories that I grew up with, but of course had no direct access in terms of language. And when I came for graduate school in London and then at Harvard, I studied under Professor Anne-Marie Schimmel, who was a lover of Rumi and worked on Rumi for 40 to 50 years. So I became even more familiar, was able to read Rumi in Persian, and finally decided, in some ways against my own will, I resisted working on Rumi because I said to Professor Schimmel that I did not want to work on something that my advisor has already worked for 50 years.
Yes.
But it so happened that there was one poem I distinctly remember. After a couple of years, I came across that poem, and it literally almost compelled me and said, this is what I want to do, because it was a multilingual poem. And it was a short five-verse ghazal, which is often translated as an ode, usually a love poem. But in this particular poem, there were verses of the Quran that were intertwined with what Rumi was trying to say. And from that day, yet again, I got committed and hooked on to what Rumi had to say for the world.
Well, his impact on the world, basically in general, people who do not know Rumi, I would say in depth, because we know him through poetry, his influence on dervish dance, and so on. But there has to be, I think there is a more profound nature to him that we don't often speak about, whereas we do that with Ibn Arabi because great profundity. And with Ibn Arabi, you don't speak too much about his poetry and more lighthearted and beauty of his work. So when it comes to the poetry, it does work. I wanted to find out from you, it does work with scripture, and it does, of course, instruct, I guess, in spiritual ritual. And so is there more information about that you can tell us with his work?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's a reason that we mentioned these two giant figures within the Muslim and Islamic sphere differently in some ways. One is seen as the great philosopher, the other the poet, and both of them have a playful side to them. And although Rumi often in his poetry will berate philosophers, there are times that he can become very philosophical in the sense of introspective, reflective. So again, they have those strands, both of them. But clearly for Rumi, it is a lot more of joy, which is very much rooted within the Islamic tradition. And for my personal scholarly and personal interest, very much rooted in the Quran, the Muslim scripture. But what I find most interesting about it is that even though, as many Persian scholars have shown, that in his Masnavi, what is generally termed as his didactic poem, there may be over 6,000 verses of the Quran that are mentioned. They are not mentioned or interpreted as it would be in general exegetical works.
Mm-hmm.
Rumi is so deeply rooted in the tradition and so comfortable with his identity within his tradition that he can sometimes very comfortably again subvert that tradition to give a very different interpretation of the Quran other than what generally people have thought about or read into it. So that's where I think I find it so compelling and just that creativity, as Ibn Arabi does also. But I'm much more rooted in the Rumi tradition. So if you want an example, as I was as I was reading up today, I was, you know, again, I've quoted many in my own work, but, you know, after 9/11, people constantly talked about, you know, how the suicide bombers may have been enticed or may have been encouraged by the 72 virgins promised in the Quran. And I thought this was very interesting that Rumi basically mentions that or hearkens that or resonates in his work in a very different way. So for him, these wonderful, you know, sort of paradisiacal houris or the angels or the virgins are essentially your fine ethical qualities. And he says, and I'm going to quote here, he says, your fine ethical qualities will run before you after your death, like moon-faced ladies do these qualities proudly walk.
Wow.
When you have divorced a body, you will see houris in rows, Muslim ladies, faithful women, devout and repenting ladies, and this is directly the verse from the Quran. Without number will your characteristics run before your bier. In the coffin, these pure qualities will become your companions. They will cling to you like sons and daughters, and you will don garments from the warp and woof of your works of obedience. You can see how he completely turns and subverts in some ways the tradition, but brings it so close to what, as human persons, what one is expected to do. And these beautiful qualities, your own ethical qualities, become your own companions. That may be what some people think of these wonderful 72 virgins that are going to be your companions.
Well, yeah, it's been brought down to media, basically, and it's a lot of, I think there's a lot of misinterpretation, which is one of the reasons that we wanted to do this kind of conference, because it brings more clarity to an entire culture, to the philosophy, to the spiritual thought of what people are trying to say about the divine, in fact, or how it affects us on even on an everyday level. And could you tell us a little bit more about your classes and what you're going to be teaching at the conference?
Yeah, at the conference, I propose to do one of another favorite poem of mine. There are too many of these that are my favorite, but this is an example of several verses of the Quran that are put together in a very open, generous manner that, again, is rooted in the Muslim tradition, but takes beyond it, and that's why I call it a pilgrim's progress, where essentially what is happening is Rumi is offering a way in this particular poem, which is a very unusual poem. It brings together 17 different verses from variety of parts of the Quran, and it's very unique, first of all, in and of itself, in the huge corpus of Muslim sort of mystical literary production. In every way, it's unique, but it's also interesting in terms of any spiritual person or anybody who's seeking to get on the path of spirituality. What are the different ingredients that one needs to put together or that will happen? So there's always this question in all the world religions about how much effort do you put in and how much is the grace that is bestowed upon you. And so, you know, generally that's called the pilgrim's progress towards higher states of consciousness. And in this one particular poem, Rumi then goes back and tells us what, you know, what these ingredients are. And I'm hoping to bring that out together with in an interactive way within this workshop to bring this out as to what are the ingredients. So the usual ones that we know about, to be patient, to be submissive, to have an ear for something that is beyond the material, to think about, and a lot of these poems start, as this one does, is to constantly say that there is a cry mm-hmm. that is constantly above all of us, that's calling each one of us to whatever our personal calling is. And we need to develop an ear to listen to it. And once we do, each one of us has a very personal, individual manner of progressing on this path, which will allow us to be much more open to what is happening around. And as Rumi continuously with the Maulavi Darwishes shows, that, you know, you're continuously moving, but you're centered too. And for one to look for this center, one needs to embark upon this path. So that's a poem that I'm going to break, you know, in a workshop situation. I can actually talk about right. the exact Quranic verses and what that means within the Muslim context, but in the much larger context of the human person trying to progress on a path of ethics, of spirituality, mm-hmm. of introspection, of generosity, of openness.
Well, one of the things I wanted to ask is also the works of these great mystics, and mm-hmm. sometimes I get the impression that even the people of their own country are not completely aware of all their meaning and all their work and all their translations, and even the United States. When attending a conference like this, what mm-hmm. do you see the importance of this in today's world, the importance of attending something like this, this kind of conference?
You're so right. In most of these countries, even though we have great inheritance, you know, the heritage of our own religions and cultures, it's often we don't have, first of all, that time to stop.
Right.
And I think a conference like this allows for like-minded goals and people to stop for a moment and avail oneself of that opportunity. But beyond that, I think in all of these the poems, the materials that these great, at least in this context, Ibn Arabi and Rumi offer to us is to somehow make that effort to stop for a moment, listen to something that is beyond the material, that is continuously a part of our lives. So the you know, one of the things they talk about is this intertwining of the material and the spiritual, and the lives that we live, that we are constantly moving. The idea that these two things are going hand in hand, but one is not aware of it. So one, I think it's the whole question about awareness to take a moment to be, as Rumi would say, be silent all the time. As much as he talks nonstop,
nah.
he also tells us to be silent, to mm-hmm. listen. And I think that something like this, as we are listening to the great scholars or the, you know, the practitioners, the artists, I think that it affords moments of those very personal silence that one can participate in while he's continuously, you know, these two are challenging us to then ask of ourselves, where are we at this moment? And I think that's one of the sort of personal benefits of, and as Michael said earlier, joys of my profession that affords me in the middle of all of the sort of conceptual and analytical work that we do, it affords me within these conferences to have a very personal participation as well.
Yeah, he's, he was brought to the United States, and I'm not completely familiar. I know that Robert Bly on and Bill Moyer's interview was speaking in. Just to quote him, Rumi and Hafez have been the guiding light, Rumi especially, of American poetry.
Mm-hmm,
I mean, he
mm-hmm.
says American poetry for the last 5 to 10 years, and this is in 2007.
Yes.
And but it almost seems to me that if we're criticizing the Muslim world so much, we should be able to give thanks for the genius that is there. So this is Persian poetry, 14th century.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So. Absolutely. And it also, you know, reminded me as you were speaking, Araceli, that, you know, these are not disparate worlds. They are continuously tied culturally, obviously spiritually, and they are intertwined in ways that separating them politically and talking about two different spheres of influence or civilization is not productive, because continuously artists, people of a certain kind are benefiting back and forth. Just as, you know, we were earlier talking about Ibn Arabi and Rumi, we'll never know whether they met.
Uh-huh.
But there was that higher influence that allowed them to take from each other and provide to the world the kind of inspiration that lasts for over 7 centuries. And to this day, their as you were saying, the sacred presence or their own spiritual status influences each one of us. And clearly the poetry of poets across these centuries and to this day, whether they belong to the so-called East or West, are continuously taking from that inspiration from that same pool of universality and generosity. And I think that's where surely Rumi is, you know, has that substratum of influences that go back and forth in so many ways.
So let's see, this has quite gone on for, just going back to the way that, let's say, the United States sees these figures, and I'm glad we're bringing Rumi up more, of course, but then there's also now Ibn Arabi and several mm-hmm. mystical figures mm-hmm. that should become much more well-known. There is a movement, especially with universities and cultural centers in the United States, to start bringing more information about this because mm-hmm. of the lack of it there has been for so long. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, mm-hmm. today in the New York Times, I think there is an article about the Metropolitan Museum that is presenting a specific emphasis on Islamic art. Mm-hmm. And if differentiate a little bit for me Sufism and speak a little bit about Sufism and how he represents that and how that culture is part of Islam, because it's considered the esoteric branch of Islam, but it's not always understood in the American mind. What does that mean?
Yeah, I think that in more contemporary times, there is kind of an effort to think of Sufism as outside of Islam. And there was a whole strain of academic writings that did that in the last century as well. But we have enough evidence, and several scholars have painstakingly showed that it is very much, it grows from the very roots of Islam, from the Quran, from the life of the Prophet himself, who was very spiritual minded. And therefore, this strain of spirituality is the very core in some ways. And the Sufis saw themselves as representing that core. Not everyone is inclined or ready for a spiritual path or make the sacrifices for it. It also acknowledges that there are some people that may have more of a literalist bend, ritualistic bend, and in all religions this is true. And there are others that work more with symbols and spirituality, and they don't necessarily give up the external or the exoteric. But these are clearly the esoterics, and Sufis right from the beginning saw themselves as that. There are different strands of Sufism that are represented often, and some of the scholars have named that. For example, Ibn Arabi is, as William Chittick has named his book, is the path of knowledge, and Rumi is the path of love. Obviously, they're not, you know, mutually exclusive.
Exactly.
But Sufism then becomes this attitude, I think, to look beyond the material, to look beyond the literal, to look beyond what the eye can see, and accept and try to cultivate an eye and a heart that sees beyond what is obvious. And within that strain, all of the people we're talking about fit into it. Clearly, Ibn Arabi and Rumi become some of the greatest exponents of this kind of an attitude. But Yunus Emre and 13th century, where all of these great people are, also becomes in some ways an expression of perhaps the time where these movements are coming into fuller force in some ways. It is a time of great turmoil with the Mongol invasion. People are moving around civilizations that they knew of that seemed to be standing on their own are falling apart. Mm. And within that moment of destruction, they bring the message of spirituality that has, a creativity and an ever-nurturing, ever-renewing aspect of the inner self, which also on the material front allows for one to recreate with greater vigor cultures and civilizations that are open to everybody.
Ah, that's the thing, inclusivity, a universal perspective, which is one of the main themes of this conference. Mm-hmm. And I think that the other thing is that you mentioned the word attitude, mm-hmm. Which is the attitude being more inclusive and universal, which is not always associated with Middle Eastern philosophy in the United States. It's true.
That's true.
This is very important to me. And then what happens is also when you say Sufism, we're not talking necessarily you're changing your religion. this is just what people, these are teachings that teach you how to live.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way we're looking at that. So do you have something else that you would want us to know about Rumi that maybe is not known about him, or anything you want to say before you go?
Well, I think one of the on a very personal note, every time I look at a poem, every time I look within the teaching context, sometimes I don't revisit my own work or look at additional works of, you know, additional poems. But every time I do, there is that larger sense of upliftment, mm-hmm. of hope. Even my own activism in so many different ways, whether it is environmental, whether it's social justice, there is this, you know, underlying principle of Rumi that constantly talks about, you know, if you don't plow the earth, nothing will grow. And that whole idea that, you know, just a couple of days ago we lost our Nobel laureate, Wangari Maathai, mm-hmm. and she again talked about being the hummingbird, being this person who will do one's personal best. And I think these are the constant reminders to be open to the materiality, but also the spirituality, to be open and generous and large enough to open oneself to other interpretations, but also continuously feel responsible and participate. And that's what propels my own sort of activism.
Ah.
And the other part, I think, is always within the Sufi message is that, you know, it's not always about destination.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always about where you're trying to go, which is what we are continuously sort of taught.
Right.
You know, there are goals and you reach that. The idea is to step back and enjoy the process.
Mm.
Enjoy the process, and each stage of that process could very well be the destination, so long as you don't become content with it and say, I have reached. It's never, because in that larger scheme, somebody higher is constantly greater than where you have reached, and
yeah.
you continuously move with that. So I think those are the kind of things that I see with Ibn Arabi when he talks about the horizon and how the horizon is the meeting place of the earth and the sky.
Mm-hmm.
But when you move a step closer, the horizon moves as well,
mm.
and that's a new vantage point from which to look at everything, rather than become comfortable in one's own opinion and close it off.
No.
And that openness is something that I think one can, within a conference like this, one can participate intellectually and also with like-minded group of people, personally engage in one's.
Well, engage in one, yeah. I think it's also a joy and a pleasure, actually, to be in the presence of. And I think it impacts the soul, which
absolutely.
Yeah, because that's one of the, actually, something that Robert Bly also said about that poetry impacts the soul. It touches the soul. It tells mm-hmm. the soul to remember.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
you're basically, you know, making a connection to the divine yet again. And so I want to tell you, this has been great. You were wonderful. And we're going to be saying goodbye now to you.
Thank you so much.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
It. Thanks
yes.
for inviting me, and good luck. Yeah, I have to rush for another meeting,
okay.
so I'm off. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay, so I just want to give you a little bit information again about the conference itself, Ibn Arabi and Rumi, Teachings for the Modern World. It's going to be held at Columbia University on Friday and Saturday, November 4 and 5. And for listeners right now of WBAI, if you get in contact with the Open Center today all the way until Monday, you will be given a discount from the current price of the conference. If you come with groups, that'll even be better for you. So please do call at 212-219-2527, extension 2 or extension 0. Again, 212-219-2527. And definitely go to the website so you can really take in the entire conference through there. It's a beautiful website. It's www.opencenter.org/Ibn Arabi, I, B as in boy, N as in Nancy, Arabi, A-R-A, B as in boy, I. So, thank you. Mm-hmm. That was David Darling. He is going to be playing at the concert that is going to come right after our conference. I'm going to introduce you to a little bit and tell you a little bit about David. Known as the Maverick Cellist is the phrase he's most assigned, Grammy Award-winning artist, David Darling hardly catches the richness and diversity, breadth and sense of the humor of a man who literally redefines the way the cello is played and the way that music is taught. His prolific collection of recordings and innovative performance style represent an eclectic variety of musical genres. His playful and unconventional teaching methods have helped open the world of music and improvisation to thousands of individuals. And throughout the years, he's collaborated with a wide variety of international artists, including musicians like Paul Winter, Glenn Velez, and Bobby McFerrin, writers such as Coleman Barks, Joseph Campbell, and Terry Tempest Williams. He is a classically trained cellist, and he served as an orchestra conductor and faculty cellist at the Western Kentucky University. And it's been so much of history. David, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, David. I just wanted to, first of all, you often work with Coleman Barks. And you will be working with him at this conference while he recites his wonderful poetry. Could you tell me a little bit more about your experience with this material as well?
Well, many of us are just very inspired by the fact that Rumi is so present in the society we live in. And many years ago, I met Coleman through some mutual friends. And as Rumi said that many times in his writings, the poetry should always be accompanied by movement and dance and music. So I was delighted that years ago, especially after the Bill Moyers introduction of Coleman, that he started inviting me to be part of his entourage in touring and accompanying his spontaneous reading of Rumi and also some of his own poetry. We all know that he's one of the great translators of Rumi, one of the most inspired people I know. He has this unbelievable quality of this southern gentleman with this drawl, which is very slow and yet very charming, and yet, of course, he's a genius of a human being and such a humanist. And it's just a wonderful, it's been a wonderful event for me to have that as part of my life after all of these years of playing in all kinds of different kinds of bands, from jazz to folk to classical.
Well, I mean, you have quite a long history here. You used to be part of Paul Winter Consortium, was it?
Paul Winter Consort, yes.
Sorry, Consort. And it's been a while, and then you went on your own. So as music, you've traveled the world. What kind, and just working with Coleman and so on, I just want to continue that a little bit more. Just tell me a little bit more about what the conference concert is going to be like.
Well, you know, the charming thing for me as a musician and one who loves many styles is that Coleman also likes many styles. So, for instance, we have not used instruments that belong to that genre of that
mm-hmm.
time.
Okay.
He's very much in love, for instance, playing. There's one piece I do with blues like this.
Very nice.
Aya Rumi, okay now, Rumi, so mama, no mama. So if you give it that flavor, you know, it puts Rumi in a whole different ballgame. Same thing with the use of Bach. You know, in one piece I play this part of Bach. That flavor, we have Bach, we have blues. Sometimes Coleman loves rhythm, so I'll play more on an African groove like this. Oh, my, my, my.
mama satundore tenda no mama mama deda o mama male tundore inda no na na no nena.
And so, you know, sometimes we get the audience to be with us. You know, it's a charming thing to hear these beautiful stanzas mm-hmm. coming from Rumi. They just, normally they kill an audience. They kill us on stage. You know, and sometimes we've done the same stanzas for years, and yet every time I hear them, I'm so inspired by the presence that Rumi has in the world. Like he's, you know, like a Mozart, you know. The things that he created with words are just beyond belief.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so happy that so many people in the world really know about it. You know,
yes.
I don't know how many of the younger generation know
right.
about it, but there certainly is more people that know about Rumi than ever before in the lifetime of this planet.
Well, this is where we are now. And I think that bringing forth much of this music, I think it does work to impact your soul. It does actually motivate you, and a lot of times it inspires people to act differently, and then, of course, as I was speaking before, universally, to make an impact in society in a much better way, which music and literature do. So one of the other things I wanted to just talk a little bit more about your background. You have Music for People, Nonprofit Educational Network. You founded, and you're very much into teaching.
Well, you know, I felt growing up in the state of Indiana that my music education was so beautiful. And for a while, I thought I would just be a music teacher, and I was, in fact. And I always felt that children deserved the best in music instruction and someone who was very positive about their participation, especially in the early years with classical music, because I felt I received so much from classical music. When I began to love jazz and learn ethnic music and to be a supporter of Hindustani music and learn to do that on the cello, I wanted to have an organization that provided an atmosphere or an environment where people could come and express themselves freely through free improvisation. And so I founded this company called Music for People, and people, anybody wanting to find that, is musicforpeople.org. It's on the web. And we have these wonderful seminars here in the East Coast, and I teach all over the world. We have it in Switzerland as well. But people are coming together to celebrate life through their own music making. And you do not have to be trained to take the workshop. And if you're a burned-out musician, you don't know why you're in music, this is the kind of workshop that we create, where there's a humorous environment, an energetic environment, and we've had quite a lot of success with it without even trying. There's just lots of us are born as musicians. I really believe every child is a musician. The only reason a child won't follow that is because somehow their teachers or some misgivings that they're given. They're taught something, or they're slapped or whatever. They're told mm-hmm. something negative. And it goes, children are so sensitive. So if you give any negativity to a child very early on, it just shuts them down maybe for a lifetime. So in my organization, we have people coming. Sometimes they're in their 50s, their second profession, and they come. They see we advertise that if you want to do music for the first time in your life and be in a positive environment where everything's going to be standing ovation for you, this is a seminar where you can really get some help with that. And I'm not trying to sell anybody anything. This is very real because, you know, I'm a very my philosophy is the first kind of sound in life is called breath. When we go like this, we know philosophically that's the most perfect musical phrase. And some people say, well, I'm tone deaf. I can't take music. And I ask them, you can hear the siren going up and down when the fire engines come, can't you? And they say, sure. And I say, well, then you can't be tone deaf. There's some psychological barrier that's happened in some individuals that all you have to do is get them to relax mm-hmm. into their own beauty and to reclaim their child. You know, I'm a Taoist by profession in a way, and the Taoists say return to child. You know, so our methodology is actually called return to child. And then this idea of recapturing that innocent energy, you know, one of the mantras we use is, of course, the laughing mantra. That's the first one. When you feel negativity or hear negativity, we all must be able to go, and then right away you go to the second mantra, which is the sense of inhaling your breath in an ecstatic way, like this, wow. You know, that thing that we see so much in a child playing. You know, they're in that ecstatic place. So our seminars are full of that kind of energy. And so I'm just so happy that it's been around now for quite a long time. And thank you for letting me share that. That's great.
Well, I mean, you're talking about music as this healing process. And actually, you actually also teach at the Open Center in our music section here. And you have courses like improvisation as a tool for healing.
Exactly.
So talking a little bit in that respect and why people love to take a course like that, if you could.
Well, you know, first of all, the first instrument of mankind is the voice. So we are creating an environment where everybody is finding their natural voice. You know, for instance, if I just play this sound, and I say, and if I put it with a shruti box or a tambura, and I start the droning. We ask people to first of all get in tune with their own sound. So if they're following the typical Hindustani music, which by the way, we need to learn a lot from ancient music, especially Hindustani music, because it's thousands and thousands of years old. They have no chord changes.
Oh.
You know, and so in modern music, which I love, it's very complex in a way compared to the drone music that's involved with every song that's in, or every raga that's in Hindustani music. It gives a person a chance to take that breath and find out where they live with their own voice with a drone. And then for them to have enough courage, if they never have done that before, to go, hey, I did it, wow, wow. And then to follow their intuitive nature. And every sound you make, you get a standing ovation. Because doing it is more important than not doing it.
You are a true teacher. That's quite beautiful. You got me going in there.
Good. Well, you come and join us for one of our sessions. It's really a lovely thing. And let me just say, the Open Center has been doing such great work for such a long time. I'm a good friend of Walter Beebe, who founded it for many years. And I'm just so glad it exists. It's doing a lot of good in the world.
We're trying. So how's about some of those CDs? Tell me some of your CDs right now.
Well, the latest one won the Grammy 2 years ago, called Prayer for Compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so happy that it was given that recognition, because, first of all, I'm a great believer in people telling the truth. And so when Howard Zinn wrote A People's History of the United States, you know, it changed my life, because I always knew something was wrong with the United States, but I didn't know what it was. And nobody, all the history books are always lying. They never tell the truth. And then here comes Howard Zinn, who really told the truth. And he changed my life. And actually, 2 weeks after he died, I was at the Grammy Awards and won that award. And I got up and I had a chance to thank Howard. Mm-hmm. And it was a wonderful to hear the ovation from the crowd, because everybody artistic, creative people all knew how much beloved Howard Zinn was. And also I dedicated that album to Amy Goodman in Democracy Now!, because we're in a time that people have to tell the truth. We need truth.
Yeah.
And we need no racial prejudice. We need to really calm down and support every human being and have one of the great education systems in the world. You know, it's a very amazing time we're living in. So That Prayer for Compassion has a lot of my belief in it about serving the poor and relaxing into something that's so beautiful. Like, my mother happened to pass during the time I did that at 94. She had a good life. So the producer and I, both our mothers passed during that time, because it took 10 years to do a CD. I'm very slow, but I try very diligently to get what I want. So we have a piece called Remembering Our Mothers, which, you know, when we decided to do that, we decided to do this kind of music. soon as you put a waltz in anything, you know, a lot of people already think it's a great thing. Also, you know, when we teach music, we know that a descending bass line is one of the great avenues to improvise over. Sort of little mother there. Oh, mama, sadoble vaj de do mano vole, e a dana sado mare de tombare dole. Oh, mama, love you. Oh, mama, love you. Sadale, lady. But, you know, part of the reason people feel good when they hear a groove like that is because it's waltz.
Mm.
You know, when you're doing, when we're doing our training, one of the first things we do to get people more comfortable is for them to discover what grooves they really know.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you actualize the groove, you know, if you're a funk guy, if that's who you are, mm-hmm. well, that's all you need to do is you follow that bliss, mm-hmm. as Joseph Campbell would say, mm-hmm. until it really rejuvenates your own sense of your dialogue with your own music.
Ah, beautiful. Are you going to play one more piece for us?
Sure. Thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. All right. That was David Darling, and he will definitely be at the concert on November 5th. It'll be at 7:30 at Columbia University. And please call the Open Center at 212-219-2527, extension 2 or extension 0, or also go to www.opencenter.org/IbnArabi, IbnArabi. And please look up, and you'll really will not regret coming to this event. Now, Nick, are you still on the line?
Nick? I am.
Oh, there we go. Thank you. I just wanted to just go back a little bit before we have Salman Ahmad come online, and just go over a little bit more about your thoughts about Ibn Arabi and his importance to and his teachings to the world. I know that the majority of his work has not been translated into several languages, especially English, and I think it's only like 16 works, and each one is probably quite large. But if you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Yeah, I think as Michael and Nargis both referred to, the value of Ibn Arabi, as I've discovered personally, is his ability to speak to you, to speak to each person at the level at which they're receptive to hear what he has to say. And I think what is so remarkable about Ibn Arabi's teaching is that it is really, in Western parlance, you could say it's a truly elevated non-dual teaching. But that's a sort of a more of an Eastern paradigm. In the Sufi worldview, it's more to do with the oneness of being, the oneness of all things, and the way Ibn Arabi talks about oneness is he talks about this transformation that can take place within the heart of each human, which is to do with the opening of the heart in such a way that it can encompass and carry all of the beliefs and all of the forms and all of the images of the world. So it's a paradigm that really, really strives for a true kind of diversity, where all the diverse beliefs that we are encountered with and that we encounter in ourselves are traced back to the One, and the One is the source of all things. And so in this model, the opened heart is the one that is capable of witnessing the real being in every belief and in every manifestation. So I think, one of Ibn Arabi's titles was the greatest teacher.
Yes.
And another one of his titles was the Muhyiddin, which means the revivifier of religion, which is to do with bringing alive again, re-enlivening religion. And I think this points to the sort of the inner dimension of what we understand by religion as something that is full of meaning and full of embodiment and full of experiential reality that we are living in our daily lives. It's not something that is transcendent and separate, but it is something that we discover within the teaching for ourselves.
Mm.
So I think that's a big part of what I kind of take away from the teaching of Ibn Arabi.
Well, one of the things I wanted you also speak about is also that because it's such work that's really living, there's a variety of things that are connected to Ibn Arabi that are going on around the world. For example, Bashara. If you could explain a little bit about Bashara, which people may not know anything about.
Yes, I'd be happy to. The Bashara School is a school where Ibn Arabi is studied in depth, and so actually, in fact, is Rumi and Hafiz and Nafiri and Lao Tzu and the Bhagavad Gita, a number of the great works of the deepest traditions of history are studied,
mm-hmm.
and they are. Although Ibn Arabi, in some ways, provides a context or a foundation for the study of these great works because of his, as Michael referred to earlier, quite rigorous application exposing and formulating all of these teachings in theological, psychological, spiritual, and philosophical languages. He was a real master at that, and was able to really articulate these things extremely well. So a deep, in-depth study of Ibn Arabi is done at the school, and that forms a foundation for then moving into Rumi and the other great teachings that we come across, including those of Meister Eckhart and some of the great Christian mystics, the Jewish mystics.
Oh.
So it's a very comprehensive education.
Wow. I mean, one of the things I read somewhere about Ibn Arabi was that he made available teachings on a multitude of subjects, starting metaphysical teachings to cosmology, neurology, the science or the study of dreams, which is where he actually received some of the information that he wrote about that would come to him in his dreams, Sufi practice, mystical estates, and also he speaks a lot about the Abrahamic figures, which not everybody would be aware of. And he, of course, will write maybe about the Virgin Mary, Abraham, Job. And it serves to connect him. And he had an opinion, not an opinion, but he had information, I think, through his transmissions. Could you, enlighten us a little bit more about that?
Yes. This is a fascinating area. Ibn Arabi was quite a visionary, as you just said,
mm-hmm.
and in many of his works he discusses visions and dreams that he has of various people. For example, there are a couple of key visions that happened to him in his early life, one of which is of Jesus, Moses, and Muhammad.
Mm.
And there's a subsequent vision that takes place with all of the prophets. And this type of transmission he talks about as a direct kind of transmission. For those who are familiar with the work of Henri Corbin, the imaginal realm, this kind of intermediate realm between the transcendent divine and the material world that we inhabit, is a world which straddles both worlds on either end and connects them. So the spiritual and the material are brought together in this imaginal realm, and one of the features of this realm is that it is the place where these dreams and these visions happen. So it's not the way he understands this, of course, is not that these are sort of fantasies or imaginings of some sort, as a result of just, you know, random brain activity. he's thinking more in terms of this is actually a part of the structure of being. This is how things are. These don't happen outside of the realm of the self-disclosure of the one being. So these are transmissions that take place in a very direct way, and he goes into enormous detail in some respects in his works, talking about how this transmission works and from whom he received certain teachings.
Well, that's great, because one of the things I also wanted to say was, just as a primer, let's say, and just if you're starting to read about Ibn Arabi, there are books that there's a variety of books on all levels, but some of the things that I was introduced to was Sufis of Andalusia by R.W.J. Austin. Also his book, which we actually used in the reading group that is Ibn Arabi, The Bezels of Wisdom. Where he goes into describing a lot of these great Abrahamic figures. And also another book that I particularly like, the Hadiths, which are like the Psalms of the Bible.
Yes, right. The collection of the sayings of the Prophet.
Right.
Correct.
And
yes.
And
some of those works that you mentioned, I think, are great primers on Ibn Arabi. Sufis of Andalusia, of course, is the very rich autobiographical details that he gives, including all of the teachers that he met and the women teachers that were being discussed earlier. Some of them are mentioned in that work. I think the other work that is often a good starting point is Stephen Hertenstein's book called The Unlimited Mercifier.
Yes.
Which gives a very good introduction to the life of Ibn Arabi and to his core teachings.
Yes.
And then, as you mentioned, The Bezels of Wisdom, the Fusus al-Hikam, is one of Ibn Arabi's best-known works, fairly short but very deep, in which he explains in that short work, his entire metaphysical teaching and spiritual teaching comes through that work. Through the lives of 27 prophets who, from Adam to Muhammad, form a cycle of revelation and of the giving of wisdom over time through evolution.
So I'm going to leave you for a moment, because I'm going to say this is WBAI 99.5 FM, and this is the Open Center Show, and we are speaking today about Ibn Arabi and Rumi, Teachings for the Modern World, a conference that's coming up on November 4 and 5 at Columbia University. And if you'd like to find out more about it, call 212-219-2527, extension 0 or extension 2. Just know that listeners at WBAI, if you call or if you go online, put in the code WBAI and you will receive a lower price on your entrance fee. So stay on the line for a bit, Nick. We're going to go to our next presenter, which is Salman Ahmad. Salman?
Hi. Nice to be on your show.
Hi, Salman. How are you?
I'm well. Just got in from Washington, D.C.
Yeah. You were out there. You're a world traveler. just so we're here, and we're talking about the conference that's coming up, and you are going to be part of the concert on Saturday night, and you will be coming in to perform guitar pieces, and could you tell us a little bit about where you're going to perform that night?
Well, you know, Maulana Mevlana Jalaluddin Rumi is like the rock star of Sufi poets.
Mm-hmm.
Since the 13th century, poets, singers, musicians, writers, dancers begged, borrowed, and been inspired by the work and the spirit of Rumi. So I thought that the music that my band, my rock band Janoon, has done has taken a lot of influence from Rumi's core message of unity, of diversity, pluralism, and to some of the poems that we've taken are inspired by Rumi, others by South Asian Sufi poets like Baba Bulisha, Lal Shahbaz Kalandar.
Mm-hmm.
So that night will be a celebration of the spirit of Rumi.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to just tell you a little bit more about Salman. He was born in Pakistan, raised in New York, and Lahore is. He's a musician who founded South Asia's most popular rock band, Janoon, in the 1990s. He's also a physician, a UN Goodwill Ambassador, a professor at Queen's College, and a co-founder of the Salman and Samina Global Wellness Initiative, focused on interfaith and cross-cultural dialogue, global health, and music education. So tell us about more of, I know you call, there's a term, you call yourselves a Sufi rock star and Sufi rock group. The two generally don't meet, so tell me more about that.
Well, first of all, I never sort of said, you know, this new Janoon's music is Sufi rock. That's something when we toured India,
mm-hmm.
you know, and as you know, the history between India and Pakistan has not been about whirling and dancing and music. It's more been about sort of, you know, conflict and war. So when Janoon toured in 1998, for the first time we went toward India, our song Sayoni, which means soulmate,
mm-hmm.
it's a Sufi metaphor, that became, number one on MTV. It sold over like a few million albums. And the journalist there came up with this Sufi rock thing. So now you say, what is the connection between Sufi and rock? Well, there is, actually, strangely so.
Mm-hmm.
One of my earliest memories of music in Pakistan was when I was 6 years old at a family wedding. And, you know, family weddings used to take place in backyards, not in five-star hotels. And the tradition in our family always was to have Qawwali Sufi singers come to the wedding and bless the wedding, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was 6 years old, there was a melody, that touched my heart. I didn't know what the words meant. I didn't know what the melody was about or even what the beat was. But it was a Tarana melody written by the great Sufi Renaissance man, Amir Khusro, in the 13th century. He was a contemporary of Rumi's,
mm-hmm.
1253-1325. And it went like this. Boom, boom, tum, ta-na-na-na-na. Ta na 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 re, om tum ta na 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 na, ta na 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 re, ta ra di da ra ri da ra, ba ra re. You know, so that repetitious chant,
mm-hmm.
it just, you know, musical vibrations, they do something to us which science doesn't explain. And it just connected with me in a huge way. And I later found out that those Tarana syllables,
mm-hmm.
Om Tum Tanana, they are they're nonsensical, but when many, many people chant with the Qawwals, the Sufi singers, it creates a state of fana, which is mystical ecstasy.
Ah.
And then, you know, last night I was in D.C. and somebody was mentioning that, you know, when the Beatles used Na 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 at the end of Hey Jude, well, did that come from Qawwali as well, you know?
Yeah.
So rock and roll and Qawwali, Sufi music, one thing in common it does have is that it wants to destroy the wall between the performer and the audience.
Mm-hmm.
It wants to create a circle of light.
Right.
I think in that sense, definitely rock music and Qawwali go together.
Yeah, it sounds beautiful. Now, you also have other work that you do, and you talk a little bit about that in reference to the UN and goodwill in Pakistan. Give me...
Yes, absolutely. I've been a UN goodwill ambassador for the UN, and my, Rumi embodied peace. Rumi's poetry is about love. It's pluralistic. It's a completely different perspective on Islam. So I found, especially after 9/11, that just playing the music wasn't enough. You have to actively speak what is the true Islam and what is the Sufi Islam. So my areas of interest are definitely South Asia, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
There's, it's been bedeviled by conflict since, the last 60 years. And more so in these times where you have both neighbors nuclear armed.
Yeah.
My message has been that we need cultural fusion, not nuclear fusion, between India and Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
And through the music, that's my focus. Also, because I grew up both in New York and in Lahore, I want to help to create cultural understanding and a cultural bridge through our nonprofit organization,
mm-hmm.
SSDWI, that's Salman Samina Global Wellness Initiative.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Now, you also will move in a variety of different ways here because being rock star, we're talking, stadiums of 3,000 people, and you're singing with major stars, and people can go to your website, which is salmanahmad.com, yes?
No, it's actually the band's
Junoon.
The Junoon means uncompromising passion, or in Arabic it means madness. When Eric Clapton wrote Layla,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
It came from that folk tale, the Arabic folk tale of Layla and Majnu.
Mm-hmm.
And Majnu is the crazy one, which the root word is Junoon, to be crazy. So you can go to Junoon.com. And we have our 20th anniversary coming up on Rumi's birthday, Friday, September 30th, 2011. And this is a collection of 20 songs, which cover Sufi thought as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be released on iTunes and all the digital musical sites on Friday.
Yeah. I wanted to also spell Junoon out in case somebody wants to look it up. It's J-U-N as in Nancy, O-O-N as in Nancy again, .com. So definitely. Now, you basically are working towards better understanding. I know you wrote a book called Jihad, Rock and Roll Jihad. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So in this world we live in, words are contaminated, especially a word like jihad, because when I, gave the book title to Simon & Schuster, they said, are you sure you want to use that word on the title? It might scare a lot of people. And I said, we're allowing extremist militants to hijack language, hijack culture, hijack faith,
mm-hmm.
because those hijackers who flew those planes into the buildings on 9/11 weren't acting on behalf of Islam. They were Al-Qaeda. They didn't represent Islam or all Muslim culture. And I think that over the last 10 years, that conversation has been hijacked by extremists. So the word jihad, very simply, means struggle.
Mm.
And its most basic level, it's a struggle to overcome your ego. On another level, it's a struggle to be economically secure.
Mm-hmm.
On another level, it's a struggle to be socially secure, and it's a positive striving to lift society up, to lift yourself up, not the word that conjures up violence and extremism.
Mm-hmm.
The Prophet Muhammad said the lesser jihad is only when directly you feel that your faith is targeted. It's a defensive armed struggle. Only in those very sort of clearly outlined terms can you defend yourself. But you cannot take the life of innocent civilians. you can't commit suicide. So I feel that not enough emphasis has been on the right wording. Of jihad. So I'd use the title so that we could help decontaminate the word.
Okay, well, that's pretty clear. And yes, because we always wondered. And in general, do you want to talk a little bit about what you're going to be teaching also? Because you're going to be teaching in the conference.
Yeah, well, I've been teaching at Queen's College for the last 4 years, and my course covers music and poetry and literature from Muslim culture.
Mm-hmm.
And it spans, it covers really contemporary and traditional sources. So from Jalaluddin Rumi to the 20th century Sufi singer Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, to rock bands who cover, or hip-hop bands, for example, Outlandish, who are Danish hip-hop band but are inspired by Sufi poetry.
Mm-hmm.
I cover film music from India, like, for example, A.R. Rahman, who's also a Sufi composer.
Mm-hmm.
And at this conference, what I'm going to try to show, it's titled Rumi in Spirit, and what I'll try to highlight is some of the cultural collisions through song and poetry indigenous to Muslim societies,
mm-hmm.
as well as this natural intersection with Western and other non-Muslim cultures. Deepak Chopra has covered Rumi, Goldie Hawn, Madonna. So what is it about Jalaluddin Rumi and his poetry and his life and his legacy that inspires people from so many different traditions and so many different backgrounds?
Hmm. Well, this is what we're going to find out. And we will have 2 days to actually enjoy as much as possible and continue on and maybe even start maybe more reading groups in the city about it. One of the last things I wanted to ask you was the idea of the impact of Sufism in the world and how it's connected to Islam. And sometimes I hear, well, you know, Sufism is not really real Islam. What do you have to say to that?
Well, simply that Sufism, I come from Pakistan, so my area of the world, South Asia,
mm-hmm.
Which Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, houses over one-third of the world's Muslim population. That's
mm-hmm.
500 million Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
And the majority of those Muslims have the strain of Islam is Sufi Islam. Like earlier this year in January, I was at the Jaipur Literary Festival, and just 2 hours away from there is the shrine, the Sufi shrine of Hazrat Moinuddin Chishti,
mm-hmm.
and it's in Ajmer. And if you go there every year, hundreds and thousands of Muslims, Hindus, Sikhs, Christians, Jains, a polyglot population, come to pay tribute to this great Muslim saint, you know, and even the emperors, the Mughal emperors who ruled India for 500 years, who were Muslim,
mm-hmm.
they said, I mean, the Emperor Akbar, who ruled India for 50 years between 1556 and 1605, he would walk barefoot to the Sufi shrine to pray there, you know. So the respect to Sufi Islam in South Asia, it has been given by the state, by society, yet throughout the last 1,000 years, you've had attacks on the Sufis by the extremists.
Mm.
Now, those extremists today could be the Taliban or Al-Qaeda
mm-hmm.
or the Wahhabis,
mm-hmm.
When they go in and they blow up the shrine.
Mm-hmm.
And when they do those acts, it gets on the media radar.
Right.
And, you know, all of a sudden you think that, wow, the Sufis are really powerless people because, you know, they're getting blown up. But the fact is that through the last hundred years, Sufi Islam has gotten stronger and stronger, and the extremists are defeated each time, not by violence. Sufi Islam is about nonviolent. It's the power of ideas. It's the power of belief. It's the power of poetry, the power of music. And again, I feel that what's happening in Pakistan and Afghanistan right now will again be defeated by the Sufis who live there.
Oh, just not there. I think Sufism throughout the world is the way that it is becoming stronger, and it is becoming a more universal and more inclusive message that people can actually come to and understand and feel good about, and not to have this other thing that's been going on for a while. And stereotyping basically several cultures. So do you have any other words of wisdom for us before you go?
Well, you know, if somebody said, what is Sufism? I don't know what it is.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's a line, a Sufi line, which goes like this.
Mm-hmm.
When you see with the heart, all the masks fall down.
Yeah.
And we're speaking about Rumi. One of his, you know, lines, which touches me a lot always, is sell your cleverness and buy bewilderment.
I like that. I like that. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right. We will be seeing you at the conference, and I just want to. So thank you, and we're going to talk a little bit more about Ibn Arabi, and I want to just reiterate something about the conference. The actual concert is called Celebrating Sufism Through Poetry, Music, and Dance, held Saturday, November 5th at 7:30 p.m. at Columbia University. Please call the Open Center at 212-219-2527, extension 0 or extension 2. Please, students definitely can come with ID for a better price, and then we can go from there. I'm going to describe a little bit about the actual conference concert. This evening we'll have the South Asian leading musical figure, who is Salman Ahmad, and he will be performing the Qawwali Sufi devotional singing ballads of the three of South Asia's most influential mystical poets. Aaron Cass, actor, musician, who's a Brit, will perform a piece dedicated to the works of Ibn Arabi. And then we will go, of course, with the great 13th century Persian poet Jalaluddin Rumi, with his poetry and commentary by Coleman Barks, who will be accompanied by, as you heard today, David Darling. And we will also have an accompanying whirling dervish at this event. So it should be, I think, a spectacular evening, really. So please give a call. This is WBAI 99.5 FM. Now, I just wanted to talk a little bit more to Nick here about Ibn Arabi, and I wanted to ask you, Nick, in reference to other events that happen around the world about Ibn Arabi, if you could talk a little bit about that, and also about Ibn Arabi is located, the society itself is located in Oxford, England.
Yes, certainly. There are all kinds of events going on. The UK branch of the Ibn Arabi Society, which is based in Oxford, that was the founding branch, holds a conference every year in Oxford at mm-hmm. the university there.
Mm-hmm.
There are also events that are sponsored in London through the Temenos Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
There are reading groups, and there have even been courses on Ibn Arabi offered at Oxford University extended education programs.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a number of different things going on in the UK. The society also gets quite involved in organizing conferences elsewhere. There have been conferences in Azerbaijan, sponsored by the Ibn Arabi Society with the collaboration of the Azerbaijani government.
Mm-hmm.
And speakers from the Ibn Arabi Society do attend many different kinds of conferences all over the world, places like Turkey, Indonesia, etc., etc. We also get involved with conferences that might be associated with people who were students of Ibn Arabi or commentators on Ibn Arabi. So, for example, in Turkey, in next month in October, there's a big conference on Sadruddin Konevi, who, interestingly enough, was Ibn Arabi's stepson and spiritual heir. And Sadruddin Konevi is one of the links that we do know of between Ibn Arabi and Rumi.
Yes.
They were both in Konya in the 13th century. They were contemporaries. And we do know that they used to meet and that they used to study together.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe there are some upcoming biographies being written on the life of Sadruddin Karnavi that go into more detail about their relationship. So this should be some very, very interesting and fascinating work to uncover in the coming years.
In the coming years, I mean, it's a vast amount of work. I myself was, I went to Konya, and I was at Sadruddin's tomb and also at Shams' tomb and, of course, Rumi. I have not gone to where Ibn Arabi is buried, which is in Damascus, Syria, is it? And,
yes, it is.
Yeah. And now there is there are these trips that sometimes are connected to the life of Ibn Arabi. Actually, I think there's one right now, isn't there, in Spain?
Actually, there is.
Yes.
I was just communicating with our other co-organizer, Jane Carroll,
mm-hmm.
who is currently watching the sunset in Ronda.
Oh, well, too bad for me.
but now this is interesting because she's on a tour, leading a tour with Stephen Hertenstein, another Ibn Arabi scholar and expert. And they are conducting a tour called In the Footsteps of Ibn Arabi.
Mm-hmm.
And in this tour, they basically follow the they follow a route through southern Spain, visiting all the places where Ibn Arabi went to, the places that he mentions in his books and in his autobiographical writings.
Yeah, it's a beautiful trip, and I only did the first leg of it when I was there many years ago, and I kind of regret it not finishing it up, but I had to leave. But, I mean, of course, it's southern Spain as well, and I'm sure that Ibn Arabi was in several countries, but in that respect, it was just there in southern Spain that we did that. So any parting words, because we're about to finish the show?
Well, I think we've had some wonderful, wonderful commentary on the vastness of the teachings that we've been given through Ibn Arabi and through Rumi.
Great. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you so much. And I look forward to seeing everyone at the conference.
Yes. So please give us a call at 212-219-2527, extension 2 or 0, if you want to join us at this conference on November 4 and 5, Ibn Arabi and Rumi, Teachings for the Modern World. It'll be held at Columbia University. If you call and you are a listener of WBAI, please use the code WBAI when you call the New York Open Center to get a much better price for this conference. So thank you.